Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The name Sir Stirling Moss is synonymous with Formula One, motorsport, and sport in general. Much like the names Ayrton Senna, Graham Hill, Barry Sheen, and nowadays Lewis Hamilton, Moss was known by everybody. Mr. Motor Racing was a true household name. Alarmingly quick, tremendously versatile, and patriotically English, Sir Stirling passed away at the age of 90 on Easter Sunday. He leaves behind a huge legacy in touring car racing, sports car racing, even rallying, and of course Formula One, where he won almost a quarter of all Grand Prix he started, and 24 podium finishes from 66 starts marks an impressive hit rate of 36%. Generally regarded as the finest Grand Prix driver never to win the World Championship, Moss finished runner-up four times and was third on a further three occasions. He competed in the British Saloon Car Championship, the Alpine Rally, the Sebring 12 Hours and the Le Mans 24 Hours. In 1955, driving for Mercedes, he won the British Grand Prix at Aintree to become the first Briton to win his home event. And in 1957, he did it again in the Van Wall to become the first British driver to win the British Grand Prix in a British car. And of course, there were other standout wins, like at the infamous Nordschleife in Germany and that 1961 Monaco Grand Prix when, over 100 laps and almost 3 hours of racing, Moss's privately entered Lotus, run by Rob Walker, held off the shark-nosed Ferraris of Richie Ginther and Phil Hill. And there was the gesture which, in 1958, saw Moss back his friend and title rival Mike Hawthorn, meaning the latter was reinstated from a disqualification at the Portuguese Grand Prix, handed back his second place, and would eventually go on to beat Moss to the World Championship. Generally regarded as Sir Stirling's greatest achievement was his frighteningly fast victory in the 1955 Mille Miglia, the 1,000-mile road race across Italy. Alongside journalist Dennis Jenkinson as his co-driver, Moss beat his idol Juan Manuel Fangio. Watching roadside that day was a 15-year-old Italian boy just 1 month before he and his family up sticks and emigrated to the United States of America. Injected with enthusiasm and passion by Moss, Fangio and another former F1 world champion Alberto Ascari, who he watched at Monza, Mario Andretti would go on to become the only driver in history to win the Indianapolis 500, the Daytona 500, and the Formula One World Championship, which he did with Colin Chapman's Lotus in 1978. I'm Greg Haynes, and this week, the Eurosport Full Throttle podcast trades in two wheels for four as we discuss one legend with another. Sit back then and enjoy a conversation with Mario Andretti, who is on the line from his office in Pennsylvania, a true gentleman and a motor racing hero. Mario, thank you very much for joining us. Obviously, sad times, but a great man, and it's a great time to reflect on Sir Stirling's life and achievements, isn't it?
Yes, no question. I think here again, we knew that he's been ill for a couple of years now, where he dropped out of sight, so to speak, and he retreated from the public appearances and all that. But again, I kept in touch with Susie, probably maybe once a month or so, and she sort of kept me abreast of things, and we chatted because Susie had a very nice relationship with my wife, Deanne, you know, so we had that sort of conversation. And again, big shock, you know, on Sunday morning when I learned about his passing. Again, it's like, family member, you can never prepare for it. And it was tough, you know, someone bigger than life like him, you know. Individuals like that should never die. But he will never die in our hearts, for sure.
Yeah, and especially during these strange times anyway, everything seems a bit surreal, doesn't it, at the moment? But, of course, you had the great fortune in actually seeing Sterling in the Mille Miglia in 1955.
Indeed, yes. Actually, that was the... I had, you know, as a teenager, my brother Aldo and I, we were just following motorsports, you know, while still, you know, living in our own country and in Italy. And as you can see, the popularity of Formula One with Ferrari, Maserati, Alfa Romeo being involved. And then of course, Mercedes entering there in 54 and cleaning house everywhere with Sterling and, yes. And of course, Fangio. But the Mille Miglia was the first race that, you know, we got to be very close to when we went to the Abetone Pass, the Futa Pass to watch. And I remember him flying by with Dennis Jenkinson next to him, and which was, you know, even then was unusual to see. But here he goes, and he wins that race. And he was part of that group of drivers of that era that inspired me tremendously. And just to go on, I was later on, once I was, you know, more involved in the international scene, that I got to meet him. And finally, you know, we were in Argentina. I think it might have been 1977. It was he and Fangio together. And we just got involved in a conversation, and they were surprised at how much I knew about their careers, because they kept saying, you know, some of the contemporaries at the moment, you know, they don't really know what we're all about as much as you do. And I said, oh, yes. I said, I probably remember more situations than you do, you know. So we really engaged, and it was really nice, actually, because after that, every time we met, you know, we had something to say. And, of course, Sterling was forever present in all the events, you know, so many events, obviously, not just the motor races, but the classic events. And he stayed close to the sport forever, you know. Even after his accident, you know, he was forever present, and everybody always revered him, and rightfully so.
Yes, and it seems like a strange irony in some ways, doesn't it, that he passed away on the Easter weekend, and he had his accident at Goodwood in 1962 on the Easter weekend as well.
I know.
But were you quite starstruck, Mario, when you first met him? Yeah, I suppose as many people must be when they meet you now. You must have been quite starstruck to meet Sir Sterling.
Oh, it was incredible. I just had to pinch myself, you know, to have the opportunity to speak with him, because, you know, individuals like him and Fonza were like bigger than God, you know, when I was a young teenager, you know, just totally, you know, infatuated with the sport. And again, you know, to finally have a really conversation, in fact, and have someone like that even notice me, and knowing that I exist, you know, was huge. So, individuals like that are with you forever. You know, they inspire me at the beginning, and I remain that way with great respect and admiration, of course.
It's interesting you use the word respect there as well, Mario, because is that something you think has changed in recent years, I suppose, with the increased safety as well? Has that certain level of respect that the competitors had for one another waned to an extent now?
Well, I don't know. I think that that part is still there. But, you know, the human element is still pretty much the same. Times have changed, situations change. But You know, I think the respect among drivers is still alive and well, in my opinion. The ones that deserve it get it. And with him, he was so aggressive but very correct. I mean, even you know what happened with when he went to bat for Mike Hawthorne, you know, that potentially had a violation, and you know, by I think reversing or something on track, and he could have been disqualified instead. And Sterling apparently went to bat for him. They reinstated him, and then Sterling loses the championship to him by 1 point, I think. Yeah. You know, so he was that kind of a guy. You know, he was again like not just liked but respected by everyone because he was correct.
Yeah, and he really believed in certain things, didn't he? One of them, of course, was racing mostly British machines. And even when he had to enter a Maserati that time, he painted it British Racing green, didn't he? He was Mr. Motor Racing, wasn't he? And Mr. British Motor Racing as well at that.
Oh, yes. He was very loyal, you know, very loyal to his country and to his colors for sure. And that to some degree might have worked maybe even against him at times, you know. People say that, but again, you know, they're men of principle, you know. Look what, you know, Dan Gurney, I think, was also like that, when he you know, he felt that he should have an American brand, American car, compete on the international market. And I think, you know, from that standpoint, he might have given up a world championship if he would have driven, say, with Lotus or Ferrari, some of the more established teams, you know. So, again, but you have to admire that sort of that type of thinking and principle, you know. And he oozed with that basic the principle. He just he wanted to fly, you know, the British flag on the international scene. You know, that was probably more important to him than anything else.
And I suppose Mario Sterling must have had a particularly special feeling because he was so versatile, wasn't he? He won at, you know, he competed at Sebring, Le Mans, Formula One, touring cars, and he pretty much won in everything he did, didn't he?
Well, that's the beauty. That's where, you know, that's where you have to appreciate his ability. I've one thing that I think has always impressed me from the very beginning is the versatility in any drivers, and that's what really I think gave me a lot of something that that's who I wanted to emulate. Mm. You know, I think it's always, you always look at someone else that is doing something that really impresses you. So what if I could do the same, you know, and it drives you to just up your game. And again, I always felt the ultimate satisfaction, you know, is to just venture over to another discipline, not just race, but win. And that's what I derived potentially from my career. That's why I so fully understood, you know, what he, you know, what everything meant to him as well. I think he felt the same way, not race there, but win. Because, you know, even especially today, there's basically drivers choose to just specialize, you know, in one category, you know, in one discipline, which is fine. You know, it's strictly a personal thing, personal desire. But some of us just wanted to venture over somewhere else, and I wouldn't change that part of my career. I think that's the part that gave me the most satisfaction, quite honestly.
Can you remember making a conscious decision in your career, Maro, that you wanted to go and do Formula One after the success in NASCAR and winning at Indy? Was there a moment when you thought, oh, that might not be a bad option?
Oh, Formula One was always in my radar. Always. When I was driving midgets, you know, believe me, that, you know, that's what really sparked my interest in motorsports, you know, at the very beginning. And again, I can tell you this, Greg, that even when I was a rookie at Indianapolis in 65, I finished third. And of course, you know, all along, we were there for a long time. And I wanted to, you know, to get to know Colin. I got to know Jimmy. And And when we were saying our goodbyes at the dinner, after, you know, Jimmy won and I finished third, I said to Colin, Colin, someday I would like to do Formula One. This is 1965. And he said, Mario, he says, whenever you think you're ready, you call me and I will have a car for you. Can you imagine that?
Wow. Wow.
You know, the sound of those words to me.
And Colin Chapman as well, of all people.
Yes, yes, yes. I mean, I was the happiest man alive at that moment, you know, but it gave me reason to just, you know, to get involved and venture more and more into road racing. And I love road racing so much that even when I was driving midgets in 63, there was only one road race in Lime Rock, Connecticut, you know, that was run, and I won that. In 65, there was only one road race throughout the championship, because I won the national championship that year. And I won that road race. So you could see that was, you know, Formula One was definitely in my, you know, in my future, hopefully. And, you know, I felt one point in my career, things were really going well here. I didn't have to do that, but I felt that I have to give it 100% go, and things worked out, you know, and God willing, it was actually, you know, with Colin ultimately, you know, that's who gave me the championship.
And not only that, of course, but that first Grand Prix, when you took up Colin's offer, 1968, Watkins Glen, you actually took pole position, didn't you, on your debut?
Yes. I mean, I just wanted it so bad. And I felt I think 1 week or 2 weeks before, I had a test in Monza, which was the first time ever in the Formula One. And I felt so at home, you know, the response, how nimble the Formula One cars versus, you know, what I had driven up to that point. Even the single-seaters Indy cars were, you know, just heavier and all that. And so the Glen was my first official race. You know, it's another story. Monza was supposed to be, but yeah. I had to come back and race in the States. And then there was a 24-hour rule that the last minute they waved at me, so they won't let me start. But the Glen, I had never seen the Glen before. I never raced there. But, you know, the car felt right to me, and I was, you know, I put the car on pole, and Lord and behold, next to me was Jackie Stewart,
yeah.
And you know, and my teammate Graham Hill was behind me, so it was really a fantastic feeling, and gave me a lot of confidence, and so I had, you know, some tremendous moments, as you can imagine, in Formula One. It was so meaningful, you know, like winning. The Italian Grand Prix, you know, that's when I saw my very first Formula One race in 54. You know, so many wonderful things have happened in my career.
Obviously, you have really known all the greats as well as becoming one of them. But like you just said, Jackie Stewart, Graham Hill, you got to know Bernie Ecclestone very well. Who did you always consider your best friends, along with Sterling, obviously?
Well, there were so many, as you could say, over the decades. You know, to deal with, you know, with the giants of the sport, you know, even, you know, Mr. Ferrari, dealing with him directly and having such a great relationship with Colin Chapman. And again, over the decades, racing against some of the icons of the sport. I mean, when I look back, you know, how fortunate have I been, you know, to at least even be able to live through all those decades to have these opportunities. So I can just go on and on, name so many people. And that's why I always I avoid just naming one or two, because I know I'm going to forget some other key ones, you know. But I've been around. I've touched, you know, I've been touched by so many wonderful individuals that and that's always kept me so motivated and everything else.
And is there something, Mario, in your opinion, about the real greats that does set them apart? I mean, is there anything they do have in common? It's difficult for someone like me to know, really, from the outside. But, you know, what makes them so special?
Well, I think it's, I don't know how other people think, but I think you have to be driven by pure love of driving and the burning passion, you know, to be able to excel. The way I looked at what I think made me a better driver is always realizing, recognizing that somebody is always better than you, and you have to incessantly, you know, improve your game, work harder. And, you know, if you're going to, you know, any discipline that you enter, like, you know, there were almost each decade's got somebody there that is the yardstick, you know, and sets a standard. And again, like you said earlier, who was setting the standard in Formula One? You know, when I was first introduced, it was Jackie Stewart. And for some reason, you know, to do something one better than Jackie Stewart, oh my goodness, yeah. You know, how sweet it is. You know, when I won my first Formula One race, you know, it was the same thing. I think Jackie Stewart finished second. A couple of weeks later, the Equestria Grand Prix, there were twin 100 milers, you know, and I won both, and Jackie Stewart finished second to me twice in that. So, and then when I got into Indy cars, you know, my rookie season and so forth, and who was the man that, you know, everyone wanted to beat was A.J. Foyt. The first race that I won that he finished second, I mean, that's something absolutely special. It's something that you feel, you know, how sweet it is. You know, this is really, you feel that you're accomplishing your most ambitious goals, and that's what keeps you going. That keeps you motivated on and on. But that's how you look at things. And again, I had those opportunities because I've been blessed to have been spared of you know, potential injuries throughout. You know, only in all my 876 races or something like that, I only missed two of them because of injury. Now, how fortunate is that?
Yeah.
Do I know it? Absolutely. Do I appreciate it? Yes.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Count my blessings.
Can you ever remember being scared? Can you ever remember a single moment, Mario, in your career where you were frightened of something?
Not really. I mean, it's frightening in the sense, you know, a couple times I've had some equipment failure, you know, a wheel come off in Michigan where I had some injuries. And I remember the one where the rear wing came off at Indianapolis, driving an Eagle car. And I had it was probably the longest time I had to think before I finally, you know, before I hit the wall. And I had nothing that I could do about it. And I figured how much that, you know, I had enough time to think, is this going to hurt? You know, at that point, obviously. But as far as if you have a fear about getting hurt or something like that, you're in the wrong business. You know, it's you have to put that aside. You know that there's a potential risk, but if you're going to do it, you're going to, you know, you have to accept that. If you dwell on that, again, you better stay home and do something else.
Now, obviously, the reason we're chatting today is because of the tragic loss of Sir Sterling, and the fear, the safety, should I say, the danger aspect of it was something Sterling always talked about, wasn't it? He insisted it should be dangerous. Do you see where he's coming from there? Do you agree with that? It wouldn't be quite the same, would it, if you didn't have that danger element there?
Well, I agree that obviously, you know, that's the part that you know, that brings the challenges to the forefront. But at the same time, I don't think no matter how much you deal, you know, you improve the safety aspect of a racing car, it's never going to be 100% safe, no question. Times has evolved. We needed to deal with that safety. I mean, look how many drivers we were losing, you know, every year, even in here in the United States, in the dirt track races. You know, 1 year we lost four guys in two accidents.
Yes.
And the two each, you know, things like that. So the sport had to do something, and which they did. And I don't think the sport would have survived in modern times, you know, if the safety aspect would not have been dealt with vigorously. Because, you know, as the sport became more and more commercial, you know, I've said this many times, you know, that companies that spend millions of dollars to be proud to be part of a team and so forth, they don't want to go to funerals, you know. And again, it's wonderful that today the drivers had the best opportunity ever to retire on their own terms. And that's a beautiful thing. Yes, the times that we've endured, like even, you know, with Sturdy when he was injured, obviously, you know, today he would have been able to drive his entire career. He would have, or at least he would have, his career would have been, you know, expanded and complete. But the danger aspect is there today as well, you know, so, but it's less, and thank goodness for that. It doesn't take anything away from the sport or the challenges that the drivers face, believe me.
I can imagine some of the protests must have been quite ugly, weren't they, at the time with the race organizers, because obviously there was money involved, circuits were having to spend money to make these improvements. But yes, like you say, I mean, we would have lost so many more people, wouldn't we?
Well, yeah, absolutely. Here's the thing. Again, you know, as drivers, I remember, why do you think the GPDA was formed?
Yeah.
Just for that, just to be able to, as drivers, we had to try to have, you know, some of the safety rules incorporated, like in the cars and so forth, where it would be across the board. Because here again, I said it so many times that almost every safety feature on a car is a performance, you know, that has a performance effect, you know, and whether it's weight or whether it's aerodynamic or whatever. So it has to be enforced across the board. And it took a while for us drivers to get the sanctioning bodies to start looking at this vigorously, you know, for the sake of really keeping the sport alive, not just us, but keeping the sport alive. And again, you know, that there were many individuals that were obviously at the forefront of this. It took a while, you know, for all of this to happen. But finally, I think that all the sanctioning bodies across the globe now are all very responsible, and they're doing a fantastic job in making this a work in progress. The safety should be continuous. And again, that's what will keep the sport alive and on and popular forever. You know, we want the stars of today, the stars that that we're enjoying, we want them to keep racing even after an incident. We want them to see racing the following week.
And just before we move on from this somber topic, Mario, is that one of the hardest things to be able to race on when you have lost someone so close to you, perhaps even on that same race weekend? That must be mentally very, very, very demanding, I would imagine.
Well, of course, of course. I mean, that's the dark side. There was always a dark side of our sport. I mean, I look back, many close friends that I lost, teammates and so forth, that there's nothing worse than that. And it, for a moment, you know, it gets you thinking, you know, will I be next type of thing, you know. But I mean, it's natural to be thinking those terms, you know. But again, there was nothing worse than that. And like I said, fortunately, a lot of that is behind us, you know. But it was forever present, you know, especially in the decades that I was active in, especially the 60s and 70s, especially, and I think in the 80s things started getting much better, but still a long way to go, because I look at my, even, you know, the car that I drove, my very last IndyCar race, I look at the cockpit of that versus what, you know, we have today, oh my goodness.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really pretty good shape then. No, I wasn't.
Yeah, it's quite scary, isn't it, when you see some of the footage from years gone by of, you know, just how high up the drivers were in the car and, how, you know, the heads, the shoulders at times well above the edges of the cockpit.
Greg, I look at some photos of the cars, the sprint cars, the midgets that I drove. You know, I'm not a big guy. My head was 1 foot higher than the robot.
Wow.
If I ever got upside down, you know, it was all over. Yeah. So, again, but, you know, we never looked at those things, you know. And, I mean, the first sports car that I drove for Luigi Chinetti in 1966 was a Ferrari 330 LM. And the roll bar was just a pop riveted on the aluminum behind me, you know.
Wow.
And the seat belts were sewn on. They were sewn on the cushion of the seat.
You know? Wow.
So they were just there because the rule was in place. But they obviously, you know, they were only there for show. And yet you get in there and you do it. But that's all we knew at the time. But again, it took a long time and lost a lot of wonderful drivers along the way, you know, that careers were cut short, could have been future champions, you know, but that's the sport, and, you know, suffered and endured those moments. So now we got, hopefully, you know, as time evolved, we became a lot smarter. That's all there's to it.
I suppose we should talk about the current champion as well as some of these past champions. Lewis is only 7 race wins away now from equaling Michael Schumacher's 91. He's 1 title behind, isn't he? He's on 6. Michael did 7. Just how good is Lewis Hamilton, Mario, when you rank him alongside people like, you know, the Mosses, the Stewarts, the Schumachers, the Andrettis, obviously, of this world?
Well, you know, that's basically, you look at his career, you know, it's he's had, you know, he's been driving winning equipment, capable of winning, you know, throughout his Formula One career as far as I could see it, and he's made the best of it, you know. The record speaks for itself. He's made the right decisions, you know, which is Fangio did as well.
Yeah.
He was very, very clever by doing that. I don't think Fangio was ever in a non-competitive car throughout his relatively short career. And I think Lewis has done the same thing. God bless him. And he's made the best of it. He still does. He certainly, you can measure up, you know, vis-a-vis your teammate, and he's shown that he holds his own. So you still have to earn, you know, these wins no matter what. And he's done that. So he rates at the very top. And like I said, the record will tell us the story. I never thought that Michael Schumacher would ever be approached in a win situation. And Lewis is still young enough and full of vigor, you know, to obviously go on and potentially smash that record. So I like Lewis a lot. I love his attitude, and again, you know, he definitely is making Britain proud in every way, and he should be proud of himself, of course.
And I can't say I really know Lewis, Mario, but what I think I do know is that he's clearly made a lot of sacrifices over the years, hasn't he? Whether it's relationships or, you know, he cut the professional ties with his father at one point to continue with his career and better his career. Leaving McLaren must have been a very big decision for him at the time. I guess there's an amount of bravery, isn't there, in these decisions you have to make off the track as well as on the track?
Oh, of course. Like I said, that I think even, you know, when he made a decision to leave McLaren for Mercedes, I in my own way, I said, what in the world has he been drinking, you know? And he can thank, the way I understand, he can thank Niki Lauda for that. He made the brilliant decision at that point. So, you know, good for him.
Yeah.
Again, you know, it could have gone the other way. I look back at my career when I came out of Lotus at the time, and I could have gone just as easy. I was invited to go to McLaren, and my heart took me to Alfa Romeo. You know, that was a mistake. If I would have gone to McLaren, I think I would have probably, for sure, not probably, you know, had better results. But you know, it's about making the right decision at the right time. And he hasn't moved around very much, as you can see in his career. But again, at the key point, he just made the right decision again, and here it is. He's enjoying, you know, probably the greatest moments of his life.
We should have a quick chat, I think, about Bernie Ecclestone as well, because he's not around quite so much as he used to be. But he's never far away, is he, Bernie? And he's got a great birthday coming up, a 90th birthday this October. What a guy. Again, I've never met Bernie, Mario, but you know him pretty well. How does, with all respect, a son of a Grimsby trawlerman in England become a multi-billionaire, not millionaire, but billionaire businessman? You've got to be a pretty special individual, surely, haven't you, to do that?
Well, absolutely, indeed. I mean, you could see that just following his career in Formula One, I remember, you know, from way back, I think it was somewhere around 72 when he, you know, we bought Brabham and all that. And he was, as a team owner, he was successful, but also he could see himself as a businessman, the possibilities of Formula One being, a global sport the way it was. Having the foresight of seizing, the world TV rights and all that is what brought them to a totally different dimension. And again, he became wealthy himself, but he made Formula One. He brought wealth to Formula One that was they could only dream about, you know, before the 90s. And again, give him credit by dealing with governments and having Taj Mahals built all over the world, you know, something to totally be proud of. It seemed like every circuit around the world is sort of a beautiful sight, something that, the country themselves are proud of, and like I said, we can definitely call them Taj Mahals.
Yes.
So, again, it just he raised the level of Formula One to the point that only probably he could do. So you can never take that away from him.
Seems as well, doesn't it, that many of these really successful people are genuinely nice people as well. When you see interviews on the television or in magazines, newspapers with sports stars or really successful entrepreneurs, the vast majority of them do seem like very nice people as well.
Well, I like to think so, yeah, because they have a degree of intellect, you know, that, they remain in so many ways. There's a degree of modesty there, you know, at least the way they present themselves, and they have appreciation for friendships, and I think that's a great quality for an individual at that level. On a personal level, I've always had a great conversations with Bernie. I stay in touch with him periodically. Called him. He was in Brazil, and said, "Give me an opinion of what this pandemic." He always has an opinion about something. I love to hear it. I always love to hear his side. Yeah, so because he always has somewhere along the line, he always seems to have an answer, right or wrong. He seems to have an answer. So I always had a great time. Just every chat I had with him, brings something interesting to the forefront. And he's a man of great qualities for sure.
And without diverging too much of your private conversation with Bernie, Mario, what is his general opinion on the pandemic? Because I'm sure if he was still heading up F1, he'd be doing as much as he possibly could, wouldn't he, to get this show on the road again, as Ross Brawn and co are doing now.
Well, you have to have a plan, you know, and, there is a plan in place. I like, even on the IndyCar scene, I love the fact that Roger Penske is in charge now. You know, he's the man, and he's the man that will always have a plan. They have a plan to start the the series, you know, at the beginning of July. And you know something, I hope it happens. But you have to have a plan, and if you have to move it, you know, so be it. You know, you have to be reasonable, but at the same time, got to have a plan. And I like the way, even you know, on the Formula One front, the way they're thinking about. Obviously, they have to make some changes along the way. You know, maybe you know, to try to slide in as many races as possible consecutively, and maybe shorten the burden on the teams and everything else by having maybe just a two race weekend, things like that. So, again, you have to have a plan. This thing, sooner or later, has got to break, you know, and we have to be ready to go. I think everybody's jumping at the bit, and I think there's going to be a lot of energy that we going to have to, you know, yes, get rid of. So there's, you know, to, you know, once we get going. So, again, everybody's, I'm sure, is very anxious. I certainly know I am.
Me too. I think we've all realized as well that although sport isn't number one on the agenda right now, it's health and safety, of course, but we do need some sport to keep us all going, don't we? I think we've all realized how much our lives revolve around it, not just on a professional level, but a personal level as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's no question about it. Again, I could, you know, we're all, so, you know, situation like this, you know, depressing at best. Mm. You know, we, like I said, we can hardly wait to see some light at the end of the tunnel, to see things, you know, that looks like they're improving. So to give us hope. And we have to, you know, on that front, we have to remain positive, you know, and as difficult as it is, but that has to be the mindset. And again, just be ready to go, you know, as soon as they take the leash away from us.
Do you enjoy the modern day Formula One, Mario? It's obviously changed a lot, hasn't it, in recent years? There's more changes coming again. Obviously the changes have been delayed now, haven't they, by another year because of this situation, but do you still enjoy the racing and the spectacle as you did before?
Absolutely I enjoy it. I love technology, you know, and also the way it is controlled, not to give the driver, you know, too many tools to work with. It's still, you know, so much you know, what should be in the hands of the driver. And and again, you know, it's still pure sport, and I love it. My bucket list is still to get in a, you know, in the latest Formula One car and just get a feel for that. You know, so I still have that in my in my blood. So yeah, my passion is alive and well.
That wouldn't be bad, would it? A few laps around Spa or somewhere like that with one of the modern day cars.
Yes, sir. Bring it on.
Are you still having plans to do the IndyCar demonstration laps? Because there's some great videos on YouTube of people's reactions in the two-seater when you drive them around at over 200 miles an hour. The reactions when they get out are fantastic.
Yeah, I'm still on. I was there ready to go in St. Pete, you know, the weekend when the first race was canceled. And I was there on a Thursday. There were like 40 people and press and everything else ready to go. Our cars were all in line. I was, my helmet was all ready. I just, and then all of a sudden, you know, everything fell apart. But, and then I'm ready to go as soon as they say, you know, it's time. So, that's why, you know, I'm as anxious as anyone, you know, to get things going.
Well, we look forward to that, Mario. And if any Formula One team bosses are listening in, give Mario Andretti a run in your car, because I'm sure that would be a great spectacle. But before we head off, Mario, obviously we did start with Sir Stirling, so I think we should end with Sir Stirling. What a great character sport in general has lost, and Sir Stirling Moss, that name, is a name known by everybody, isn't it? It's not just Formula One fans, not just motor racing fans. Everybody knows Stirling Moss.
Absolutely, bigger than life. And and for us to have had the opportunity to know him and meet him, we're that much richer because of that. And again, is an individual that will never, ever be forgotten.
And I think it's fair to say by the sounds of what you've mentioned in the interview here today, a lot of what Mario Andretti achieved and became is thanks to Stirling Moss.
Indeed. Yeah, that's right. You have to have always somebody to show the way and inspire you. And he was one of those for sure that inspired me. Absolutely.
Mario, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure again. All thoughts, of course, with Sir Stirling's friends and family. And hopefully, Mario, we won't leave it this time for 8 years before our next conversation.
Anytime, Greg, anytime at all. And it's a real pleasure speaking with you again.
Well, I have to say it was an absolute pleasure to chat again with Mario Andretti. What a lovely, lovely man he is. What a great philosophy on racing and on life in general, of course, as we remembered the legend that was Sir Stirling Moss, who passed away on Easter Sunday at the age of 90. Well, Full Throttle will be back very soon indeed. And this time we'll be chatting away with Mick Grant, the seven-time Isle of Man TT winner, about a fellow seven-time Isle of Man TT winner, the late, great Tony Rutter, who we sadly also lost earlier this year. So Mick Grant on the next episode. But for now, many thanks to Mario Andretti and many thanks to you from myself, Greg Haynes. We'll be back soon for the Eurosport Full Throttle podcast.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.